What a great sound, huh? So I was thinking as we were sitting, Roshi couldn't be here today because she's officiating at the funeral of an old and dear member of our Sangha, Al Jones. Al was he worked for the MTA. He was a token clerk when there were tokens, and he began sitting with us way back when in the apartment on Washington Place. Hadn't been around much in recent years, but he will be missed. He was a great guy. And I was also reflecting on the brand new students who went through initiation yesterday, who will be joining us this afternoon. And those of you who are going to be here for the afternoon session will have a chance to welcome them. So one of the old timers takes his leave, and we've got three new members who have decided to formally ask Roshi and the teaching staff for the Buddhist teachings. So we keep on going on. A couple weeks ago, I got kind of a strange phone call. I got a call from Scholastic Publishing right across the street here on Broadway, and they wanted to pick my brain on this book they were putting out. Apparently there's quite a good illustrator named John Muth, who was also I think a Zen practitioner, or at least he follows Zen closely. Anyway, he does Zenny books, and Scholastic Publishing had gotten this bright idea. Well, we got all this John Muth art from his various books, and we can come up with another book just by republishing his artwork and putting like a pithy Zen phrase that goes with each picture. And so this editor at Scholastic went on the internet to pull off some Zen phrases, and she wanted to run them by me, asked me if they were really Zen or not. So I thought I would share some of the ones that she emailed to me. What we do today is what matters most. With our thoughts, we make the world. From stillness, life rises. The way is not in the sky. The way is in the heart. There were a bunch of others too. So, I don't think there is anything there that anyone could say boo to. They're wholesome sentiments, and if what Zen were about were just memorizing a few wholesome sentiments that you could write on a slip of paper and put into a fortune cookie, we wouldn't have to do so much work. We wouldn't have to do stuff like this. So the essential problem wasn't so much that the phrases she picked out weren't Zen. The problem was with the whole project. The whole project is that there's some assume that there are some particular Zen truths to be realized. And of course, some of you are familiar with a koan that explains why such a project doesn't really have much to do with what we're about here. It doesn't have much to do with our moment-to-moment practice. So a monk came to Joshu and asked, "Does a newborn baby have the sixth consciousness?" And Joshu said, "Like a ball tossed into swiftly flowing water." And this monk went to another master and says, "What does like a ball tossed into swiftly flowing water mean?" And the master said, "Moment to moment, nonstop flow. Moment to moment, nonstop flow. How could you possibly capture the moment-to-moment nonstop flow of our experience in some kind of phrase, no matter how heartfelt or wholesome or sincere it is? As soon as you release the ball into the water is already different, and the ball is gone." There's nothing to get a grasp of. There's no sugar cube for us lazy flies to settle on and get our daily dose of sugar. What is alive is our life, our practice. And, you know, it's miraculous and completely ordinary at the same time. Every single person here has been encountering this nonstop flow in your Zazen practice. You know, you sit, you hear the rain, you see people's feet, you see the floor, you feel the breath in the hara, thoughts come up, you let them go, you come back, nonstop flow. Zazen isn't a means to get to the truth. Zazen is the truth presenting itself in a very pure, stripped-down form. We can just sit and look reality in the face. Just sit and be the vanishing ball within the non-stop flow. And miraculous as it sounds, it feels quite ordinary while we're doing it. There's nothing special about it at all. Yamada Roshi said, "The realization born of Zazen is merely a fact, an experienced fact, in the same way that the taste of tea is a fact. A cup of tea has no thought, no idea, no philosophy. It tastes the same to Buddhists as it does to Christians or any other religion. There is no difference at all." So we come together to sit as a Sangha and just to be here with this fact, with this miraculous, ordinary fact, with this moment-to-moment practice. Does that mean that after 30 years of devoted Zazen, we're exactly the same as we were on the first day we ever did Zazen? Well, yes and no, you know. The sky is still the sky. It's no more the sky today than it was yesterday. But looks quite different. And there's been a lot written in the teachings about the changes that take place in consciousness, or the opening of consciousness that takes place as we pursue our practice, as not as we transform ourselves into celestial beings, but as we become increasingly intimate with this nonstop flow, increasingly intimate with our own qualities, hearts, and minds. We go deeper and deeper and deeper into ourself. There's no end to it. And going deeper and deeper into ourself, we go deeper and deeper into the reality of all of our lives. So the structure of these traditional explanations of the transformations that take place is kind of old-fashioned. And I think the important thing as we consider these old models is to just get the general thrust of them. They're no better or no worse than any other models, but they have a certain explanatory power that draws our attention to what it is to become more and more intimate with our lives and with ourselves and with the three treasures. And so this structure is alluded to in the koan. Does a newborn baby have the sixth consciousness or not? So in the traditional model, in the Lankavatara Sutra and adopted by Zen and some other Buddhist sects, there's a structure of eight consciousnesses or vijnanas. And the vij and vijnana is kind of interesting. It means dividing, that which divides or distinguishes. So you think of reality as like a pie in your face every nanosecond, you know, the nonstop flow. The vijnanas are the way in which we try to make some sense of it in our human realm. And the first five vijnanas are simply the five senses, the eye, the ear, touch, hearing, all the things through which we take in the world. And the sixth one, the sixth consciousness, is mind. And mind sort of synthesizes the input from those five and is also conscious of thought. So our thinking is also considered to be an object of perception in this scheme. Just like, you know, we see the floor, we appreciate our thoughts through the faculty of mind. And in this sixth consciousness, it's all assembled and we're able to say, I see the floor floor is brown. I had a thought, I'm going to let it go. Come back to the breath, and so on. So far, not too problematic. Things function very smoothly and naturally, just like they do in our zazen. And then we come to the seventh one, which is one of the most wonderful and also one of the most problematic aspects. And this is our emotional clinging. So we receive these inputs through the six consciousnesses, and then we get into grasping and aversion. Oh, that feels nice, more of this. Oh, enlightenment, I want some enlightenment. Oh, no, this is very deluded. I can't let myself think that. I won't be a good Buddhist. Oh, it's raining, I don't like rain. I wish it were the way it was yesterday when it was sunny and clear. We're all familiar with this, and this is what the Buddha taught was the source of our suffering, this constant grasping and aversion. And that's the seventh one. It's called manas. But you know, even though it has this problematic side, it's also our passion. It's also our capacity to love, our capacity to be moved and to be excited by the world. So, you know, it's not a matter of like cutting out this bad seventh consciousness and being like the baby who doesn't have it yet. You know, the baby just takes it all in. And then the eighth consciousness is called is the alaya, the storehouse consciousness. And that is simply vast luminous space in which all of the stuff from the other consciousnesses is stored as seeds, and these seeds will continue developing according to causes and conditions. So the alaya in this scheme is where our karma, that's where all the cause and effect of our lives is stored, our future in embryo. So that is the structure of what I think we can put in quotes of our deluded human consciousness. And as we become more and more intimate with this nonstop flow, this consciousness continues to develop and develops in some interesting ways. We hear a lot about wisdom in the teachings, and according to this ancient structure, these various vijnanas undergo a transformation into four different kinds of wisdom. So the alaya becomes the clear mirror wisdom, luminous and empty as the sky, the wisdom to receive the entire world, the whole shebang, to allow it, the space to allow it all in when we get out of this dance of grasping and aversion. And that naughty manas consciousness, the one that clings and pushes away, is passionate in love and in hate. That becomes the wisdom of equality. And it's kind of an interesting thing when that intimacy happens. So there's this luminous space that we have access to. Everything can come in. And it's not like we don't have things we like or dislike and so on, but somehow we stop doing the dance. There's room for what we like to be there in the space. There's room for what we dislike to be there in the space. There's room for Jesus Christ and Gandhi to be there in the space. There's room for Hitler and Stalin. So this wisdom opens up when just for a moment we stop doing this push-pull dance and we just allow all our loves and all our hates to be there as our family. Then the sixth consciousness, the consciousness which is thinks, you know, this is a floor, that's a wall, and all of that, which synthesizes the information from our senses, becomes the consciousness of intuitive wisdom. So it's not just a matter of attaining knowledge of the world by labeling it and filing it away in a drawer. This is why all those pithy little statements that my friend got off the internet don't amount to a hill of beans. That's if there isn't the wisdom of intuition underlying our knowledge, we're going to have a lot of labels, but we're not going to have any idea of our direction. We can't figure out our true direction in life. We can't figure out what our spirit needs. This has to be intuited through this kind of discerning wisdom. And the final one, the five senses, they become the perfecting or the performing wisdom. In other words, we can use all our input, our thoughts, the sights and sounds of the world, everything. We can use it to transform our lives, to save ourselves and others from suffering. So it's kind of a dusty old scheme, but if you look at it, you can see that there is kind of a gist. And the gist is we can be much bigger and much more open-hearted than we are. We don't have a need to live our life in this kind of defensive crouch where we're constantly trying to ward off stuff that doesn't feel good and to cling to stuff that does feel good. We can allow all the aspects of the world to be ourselves. And the dichotomy between taking care of ourselves and taking care of all beings begins to become very blurry. We eat so that we have the energy to practice. And through our practice, in this changing world, the rain falls, the crops grow, they're harvested, they're consumed, old men die, young people become students of the way. All of this is who we are. And it's not a matter, of exchanging the eight consciousnesses for the four wisdoms. It's just a matter of becoming more intimate with the essential openness and impartiality of our true nature, and trusting our nature. It takes a lot of trust to let it all in. It takes a tremendous amount of faith in the Dharma. But when we stop clinging, that faith is very easy to find. It's just a matter of knowing that when clouds gather, there's going to be rain. And when the rain washes the pavement, the streets will become clean. And if the sewers aren't clean, they're going to back up. It's not faith in anything miraculous in the sense of water from wine and wine from water or any of that. It's a matter of faith in the miraculous ordinariness of everyday life. And we have a chance to be intimate with that miraculous ordinariness today, right here and now, in our Zazen practice. We have a chance simply to be moment to moment, nonstop flow, and to give rise to this wonderful world of ours. And the wonderful thing it is to be human in each moment, and in each moment it dies away. Very ordinary, very miraculous, and the birthright of each one of us. We have a chance to embrace that today. Don't settle for less. Don't settle for a slogan. Open your hands and receive your birthright.